Accession number 4662, rule number 3.
Anderson, Reel 3. You were describing the duties of number 28 Squadron as an Army, Cooperation Squadron.
Yes, I just got as far as close reconnaissance with telephony. But the sets had to be, those appropriate sets had to be put near aircraft by the wireless operator and tested on the ground. And then the pilot would do the talking with a microphone in his cockpit, while you just kept your eye on the set in the rear and listened out that everything was going all right, as far as he's concerned, because the pilot did the reconnaissance and passed the messages. And on the ground, there would be a RAF wireless operator with a receiving set, an RAF receiving set. And this took many forms. It could be a static station. They'd rig up two masts with aerials between them. There'd be a short, fairly short aerial, and with a ground copper sheet of netting on the ground for the ground, the area on the ground, which used to happen in those days, and that's one station. Another one, as we have even fit up times, be a requisitioned Indian lorry. You stick four poles up each corner, and put our wireless set on this lorry. Or bus, sometimes a bus, and again put down our copper mat either on the floor of the bus or on the ground outside, and communicate with the aircraft. And another method would be on a mule. We even tried a mule, putting a set on the mule, and with an Indian attendant, of course, to pull the mule along, the wireless operator marching beside the mule, communicating with the aircraft. Another unusual job for an airman. So all these jobs came our various ways, and all took them in good part. Also, another job as a cooperation squadron would be artillery spotting, with a transmitter. We didn't carry a receiver for this; we just had a transmitter. We spotted with artillery, the Morse code key fitted in the pilot's cockpit. The pilot did the spotting. And the judging of the distance to fall the shells. The battery would put out a sign saying they're ready to fire. And then when the pilot was in position to observe the target, watch the drop of the shell, he would send a signal. The old alphabetical code would be a KTOC, KT, and that meant fire. And the battery would fire, and using the clock code, the pilot would notify the position, say 500 yards at 3 o'clock, would indicate the shell had fallen at 3 o'clock in relation to the target to the battery, and 500 yard distance. So they'd correct their sights and put out their ready to fire signal again. I think they'd used white ground sheets or canvas ground sheets, long strips, use them quite a lot for dropping points, any messages, put an arrow for pointing at anybody, say in the hills or any direction to go in to look at, do a reconnaissance. Quite a good way of communication, you can see it at a glance. And also, say, with the spotting of the shots, so it went on and on until the battery getting fairly on the target or on the target. And in training, we did this by having a barrow with lots of reels of wire. We put these wires out at various lengths on the airfield, and at the end of this wire would probably be a nail and a board, or two nails, and put a little bag of gunpowder, or open a little bag of gunpowder and put this powder on the on this gap, a spark gap. It would be in another case. We had an old spark transmitter, which we used to use during the First World War, and when you pressed a key, sent a current through this wire, and it sparked across the gap and ignited this gunpowder, which went off with a sort of loudish puff and a dense cloud of white smoke. I mean, it couldn't be, probably may not have been gunpowder, maybe a special powder with gunpowder in it. It was quite inflammable. The one slight, only small spark needed to set it off. And this would indicate the shell drops. That was just practice. And we'd have a receiver on the ground and just make the corrections, and or the pilot make the corrections, and we try to imitate a battery getting nearer. Or if you felt like a bit devil, make the shot go further afield. It was entirely up to the operator below where he dropped the shells. That was another experience. That, and go on that later when we go away actually with the army. But this is the training or the work. And also, we did message picking up with actual physically picking up of a message from the ground. This was done by two posts, either embedded in the ground, upright posts, or as we did, as for convenience, we just put them in the hub of two spare wheels, drop them in on the airfield, and with a loop of string on two projections on top of these poles. It would be only about 4 feet high, or not more. And the aircraft and this loop of string would have a message bag of multicolored canvas with a lead weight in it, which is also used for dropping messages, physically dropping a message. And the aircraft used to fly low in between these two posts, lowering a crook shaped message picking up hook underneath, rather like a huge shepherd's crook, and just fly straight between these two posts, low flying, the hook just above the ground, and would automatically pick up the string stretched between these two posts, and just climb away afterwards, and the air gun or Balsar bridge in the back would just lean over with a bit of rope, attach the hook and pull it up, and pick the message off. And on one occasion I did this, my very first flight in a Bristol fighter doing this particular job. I was told to do it, and I just did it. And I now pulled this up, and it came, the hook came up between the exhaust pipe, came down the side of the cockpit. And I pulled it up, and the hook crook part, or the circular part, or whatever it is, came up just between the exhaust pipe and the fuselage, which is a normal resting place. I thought, how do you get it off? And I tried to put my hand down between the exhaust pipe and the side of the fuselage. I take it off, and my back of my hand touched the exhaust pipe. I didn't feel anything, but I just saw my skin peel off when I touched the hot exhaust pipe. And then I realized, good Lord, that's not the way to do it, surely. So it was supposed to cool air. I didn't feel the burn at all. Of course, the obvious thing was just lower it about 6 inches and reach below the exhaust pipe and unhook the message and just pull it in, take it out of the bag, give it to the pilot. And if he wanted to drop a message, he would write one out, put it in the bag, and give it to his VAS operator or air gunner, whose job was to throw it at the dropping point, which would again be marked, or you'd know the dropping point. And he became quite expert eventually. He flew about probably only about 50 feet or so, low flying, past the brigade headquarters overhead, where everyone had dropped the message, and just threw it as you saw it approaching. And you could almost drop, as I did on one occasion, my message fell right at the brigadier's feet, and he had to stoop down and pick it up, and I thought it was fantastic, marvellous effort of dropping a message, right, where a man didn't even have to walk to pick it up. Of course, that didn't happen every time. That was just a sheer matter of luck. That's generally the work, as far as I can think, at the present moment of our work, but this became more concentrated later on. I'll go on to our detachments with the army. This is just a brief outline of our work generally and our training at the squadron. Also, at the squadron, the normal routine there was this early morning to work with gunfire. We started with gunfire, it was quite dark, because the lights would be on in the bungalow, or dim lights all night, and this gunfire be brought round by our bearers, we could get from the cookhouse, because that's the thing that made life quite bearable, or not quite bearable, it was bearable in any case, but why I liked it immensely, we had bearers look after our well-being, and Bearer and his chico, his little boy, then they had to look after us as a servant, say each bearer had about six men or so to look after. And he was responsible for cleaning all your blanket and your equipment for guards or any other duties, cleaning your boots, putting out your clothes for the look for the laundryman. If you thought it was dirty enough, or you thinks it should go, you put out your laundry, just put it on the floor beside your bed. That's for the laundryman to pick up, and he'd make your bed. Yeah, all personal service. The only thing he didn't clean was one's rifle. That was always locked up in the rack in the bungalow. And that's the only thing he didn't clean. Tell the bearer, I'm going on guard tonight. By evening, all your khaki equipment will be blankoed. Your topi would be cleaned. You should clean it with sand, wet it, and cover it with sand to dry it out, then brush it off. It's quite a good way. It's just keeping nice and clean. And that's our number one topi for drills and praise, etc. Not our working one, because you can't get grease out that way. And they made life very, very comfortable, really. So we had a bearer. He used to bring round our gunfire of the morning, and a biscuit if you felt like eating one of the biscuits. Very few people touch the biscuits anyway. And then we got up and shaved. Probably we didn't shave like this. I must have done first thing in the morning. Yes, and from there we paraded and marched across during the winter, whether it was mild, or the first morning was marched across. It was cool. Right to the airfield, to the technical side, and then began our day's work. This would be round about, probably at work by 6 o'clock, not later, and would probably do a morning's work before breakfast. We only have our gunfire and biscuits that we would have, and go out, do our flying. Any wireless set that was needed for immediate flying first thing in the morning. Bus operators usually have to do extra work of an afternoon, go to the hangars of an afternoon, and fit up the aeroplanes while they were in the hangars. Now, one and only hangar there was a corrugated iron hangar, and it was like an oven during the summer. You'd go there just with a pair of shorts, and it's dripping, just perspiration, just a stream off one. And of course, it's quite easy to get electric shocks when you're in that condition. So I think if you hear a wail from a cockpit, somebody puts their fingers or their knee where it shouldn't be, get an electrical shock. But we just took that as part of the job. It didn't matter, because we're up near the technical side where they had the fire pool, which was designed as a swimming pool where one could go for a swim, where the water was reasonably fit and contaminated with odds and ends, because water was could be quite short there at times. So if you went up to work in the afternoon, it meant you could have a swim. You're already there for a swim afterwards, so it's a matter of just sort of from hot perspiration you went to a cooler water, and I had a swim, and that freshened one up again, and back to one's bungalow again. But it meant a lot of hard work to get these things in the aircraft of an afternoon and fit for the first morning where we had just arrived. We could get to work first thing in the morning and work a normal period of 2.5 hours or so, or 3 hours, as one would do a morning and would work in a station before lunch. Then we'd knock off for breakfast. During the summer, they'd have a lorry. We'd all pack, climb onto the lorry, take us back. It would probably be hot by this time, unless you were unlucky and had a little bit of work to do, or came down late flying, and you had to walk across the airfield to the domestic side for our breakfast. We had breakfast, and the food, I think, was quite good. I, probably being young, I'd have always had a good appetite. I never objected to the food, never moaned about it, I don't think. And to make it life a bit easier, there's always native wallahs and people outside the cookhouse, or selling anything anywhere. Outside the cookhouse, there would be the muckin wallah, we call them. That's the man with the butter and the milk. Muckin wallah and the dude wallah, the milk wallah. They'd have milk there, so you could get an anna's worth of milk in your mug. So you had a nice cup of tea for your breakfast. The service issue, milk was very scant. You get very dark sort of tea, strong tea. So if you had an anna's worth of tea from the milk wallah, just a little bit in the bottom of your bond's mug, that made all the difference to a cup of tea for breakfast. and a little bit of butter, just a small pat again for a nana, or anything else there they'd be selling, probably cold meat, so you wanted a pie or a bit of cold assorted meat. Of course the Hindus wouldn't touch meat at all, and Mohammedans don't touch pork, so it makes your choice rather limited. It depends on the seller and who handles it. Anyway, that made one's meals more and more pleasant. And this again happened, if I deviate a little bit, go to our hill station, they'd have the fruit wallet outside the dining hall. You'd buy plums or fruit, and they always made them wash it in the pinky pani. Pani is a name for Hindustani for water, and the pink was the permanganate of potash. They had to wash all the fruit and vegetables, dip it in this bucket of water to clear any disease or such like from them, or any infection, liable dysentery, liable to pass on through handling vegetables. And or they have fruit, or even watercress. You could buy watercress to go in with your tea. It was all very pleasant in these meats and pies. But going back to work again, knock off for breakfast. And we have a very short break, wouldn't be a very long breakfast, probably 3/4 of an hour or so. And then again onto the lorries, take us back to work for the second period of the day, which would go on with our training, whatever we're doing. If we weren't training flying, there'd be probably gunnery practice in the firing range for the gunners. And the photographers, of course, would be photographers taking photography. And that'd be a work till about 1 o'clock. That'd be our second session, and final working session of the day, unless it's extra special that need afternoon, evening flying, or night flying. We did night flying occasionally, but that wasn't normal routine every night, just probably once a month they'd have night flying, keep the pilot's hand at night flying, which again usually entailed wireless sets of some sort, with at least one aircraft. So routine was fairly reasonable. In the afternoons were quite free. You could go swim if you wanted, walk across the field, but I had become by this time very adept at hockey. I was asked to play on one of our detachments away with the army. We only had, used to be about 12, 13 airmen, four or five officer pilots, and probably a couple of NCOs. That would be a detachment with four aircraft to cooperate with the army. And of course one day they tried to want to get a hockey team, always played the army units nearby with hockey on their pitches. And this particular day they wanted one extra player. And they hadn't anybody who could play hockey. So they turned to me. Can you play? I said, no, I never played hockey. Well, you're playing this afternoon then. So I turned out for hockey. I had a Pears Encyclopedia I bought. I don't know why, it was very minor information, the Pears Encyclopedia in those days. And it had the rules of hockey on the back of this. So I read up the rules of hockey. All the knowledge of hockey went on the hockey field. They played me out on the wing where I couldn't do much damage. And strange to say, I enjoyed myself out there. Of course, I got blown with a whistle, could not lift the hockey stick above your shoulders. Of course, I wasn't used to this control on my first game. I often got this whistle blown against me for a foul hit. But that was by the way. So I enjoyed the game, reasonable success. And next game, I found I was playing in the back position. They said, you're good enough for the defence. And from then onwards, I always played in defence, either left or right back, throughout the rest of my service in India and my service in Egypt. Always played hockey. I took it like a duck taking to water with hockey. I had a good eye, good coordination. Don't know if Bain held fencing helped or not. But I've achieved quite a good standard of hockey. I thoroughly enjoy my games. Injured at times, if somebody hit you with a stick, but that's nothing. You're healed up when you're young. And that was another sidelight of my life in India, was the hockey. And I remember one particular period of I think 21 days I played in 17 matches. There's always something going on every afternoon, either a soccer match. I played soccer now and again. They always called me in reserve when they couldn't possibly make up a team. But I never achieved success in soccer as I did in hockey. It's strange to say, I just couldn't kick a ball cleanly every time. So, but I enjoyed the fun of. I played a little tennis now and again, but hockey was my main game. There were so many regiments round about there, and police teams and such like, always playing somebody or the other. And it was a very good game indeed. I liked it. It was very fast on the hard, smooth pitches, the mud pitches, very smooth and very fast.
I wonder if you could describe here what the station at Mbala was like.
Yes, it was an open plan of, I think we had five or six of these bungalows. They were huge buildings of, first friend, they all raised off the ground some distance, up a few steps, four or five steps. And that stretched all the full length of the bungalow, these steps, and they went up into an enclosed veranda, pillars, archways, and that was an open veranda right round the outside of these buildings. Then you went into the next part of the building, which was an enclosed veranda. You went through the wall, which had open, with no windows, just had open arches, but on a wall. I think the army or sometime, or the army people may have occupied this open veranda, but then the part we occupied was the centre part. Of course, it was for coolness, really, for the double verandas to keep them cool, and all the open archways let the air circulate. You came to the inner part, which had, which was quite wide. Even the inner part was quite wide, and then it went up to a roof. The others had sort of flat roofs. This one went up to a sort of apex roof, the inner part, and they had skylights along the top, give them more light. But they were all give more light, but they were all painted black, so keep the place dark through the day for coolness. And they're quite a height. I couldn't kind of imagine how high they would be, but they all seemed tremendous to me, and probably about more than 20 feet or more high. It wouldn't be a ceiling, just got the tiles and the rafters, but more than 20 feet easily. It must have been 25 to 30 feet, I should imagine. It's difficult to think back how high they were, but thinking about 6 foot height men going all the way up, it could take quite a lot to just get to the roof. And there we lived under the centre part. Had beds down both sides. They had long walls with open archways up to sort of just a little bit more than the waist height. And there on this sort of archway you could put your mirror, your shaving kit, and your hair cream or whatever you had there. Some people even had plants there, or photographs on these little open arches beside the beds, and it went down both sides of the bungalow with big arches in the centre, where from the main doorways, but there's only entrance, no entrance to the other anywhere else in the centre of the big bungalows. And we had, as we call them, the beds McDonald's, because they had no give. They were just solid iron, and you pull them out, and you slept on biscuits. The army term for these square-shaped for the mattresses. They were filled with coconut fibres. They were filled. Our bear used to fill these with coconut fibres, and that was our mattress. Well, more apt your bear was at filling these things and fluffing the coir out, softer the bed you got. And you had probably one or two blankets. I forgot what the issue was. You had sheets there. You bought your sheets in India, strange to say, as part of your kit. You had to have three sheets, or to maintain three sheets, or worn out, you had to buy another sheet. And so, on top of that, each side, there'd be punkers going backwards and forwards over the bed. And these were driven by electric motors up in the ceiling, quite high, because the motor did quite a short movement with a crank on the wheel at the end. But it drove all these punkers at the back, went backwards and forwards, because time that these are then they spend on wires with a punker just above the bed, a bar just above the bed. And of course, the small movement up top swinging these things, you've got a very large movement down below. And to make it even more cooler, we used to put a small bit of linen, cotton curtain hanging down, but we used to put a blanket over them. So when we got into the bed or lying on the bed, the blanket only just used to miss your face for about a couple of inches or so to keep away all mosquitoes. Yes, this blanket just used to miss our face by a couple of inches, and therefore you would have a peaceful sleep of an afternoon without being worried by flies, and at night by mosquitoes. Very, very seldom in the birds, but as far as I can remember, I've ever bitten by a mosquito or sandfly, though a lot of fellows did have minor attacks of sandfly, mostly sandfly, rather than malaria. But it's just pride of service in those days. You never thought of going to the medical officer saying, I'm sick. You'd rather suffer in silence. Powell would go to the medical order and say, can I have a sweat powder? So he used to get these sweat powders, he used to call them, I don't know what they were really, from the medical orderly, and give it to his bedmate, and pile all the blankets I could find on top of him, and sweat it out. Probably a day or two, he'd be all right. But I never thought of going to see a medical officer. It's sort of beneath one's pride to have to admit you're rather sick. Strange now, I think people just rush off to the medical officer's slightest excuse. But then they sort of excuse him from work. They say, well, you're going to be bungalow orderly for the day. In spite of being in bed covered in blankets, you'd be a bungalow orderly, because you always kept one man each day in the billet. He was to general supervise the cleaning. The sweepers would come in, the cleaners would come in and sweep out the bungalow, and the bearers would go about their work, clean the kit and things like that. But mainly as a guard, that was the job really of a day. Look after the bungalow. Somebody, a presence there was needed in each bungalow, and he was nominated as the bungalow orderly for the day, and you didn't go to work. So a man who was sick or got a fever, he'd be bungalow orderly for the day. But the natives were very, very honest. If they found an odd animal on the floor, they'd come and bring it to you. Anything like that, or anything they found that shouldn't be on the floor, they'd bring it to you and you know who it belonged to. They're very good. The only thing, of course, you have to be careful of any raids on for rifles or ammunition. You always kept your rifle in a rifle rack, which is locked up, which the bungalow always had in his pocket. He went off duty to hand over to another one. You always had the keys of the rifle and the ammunition box. The heavy box full of ammunition. Because the Indian Mutiny, as you know, broke out on a Sunday. That tradition still carried on in those days. We went to church. One went with rifle, 50 rounds of ammunition to church on Sundays. A terrific clatter. Went in, everybody putting their rifles down in the queue in front. We had church parades now and again, but Air Force didn't go very often because the Army was a regular thing, but every Sunday, big parades, bands and such like. But I know when we did go to church, the parson said in the pulpit, I said, it's nice to see the church full today. He said, even the Air Force are here with us today. So it was quite an occasion when we went to church. Our commanding officer thought, well, we did enough work, enough parades. It's not our job to do these parades, which was just a matter of showing the flag. You know, the army, one of the next door regiment, when they were posted to Ambala, I think they took 3 months marching there. Went march one end of into the other, just showing the flag as they're going to the new station. So it was just part of an exercise. They went to the hill station. They marched, did a route march or forced march as part of an exercise to go to their nearby hill station, probably 30 miles or so. They did a forced march of 30 miles. See how quick they'd get there. And don't help any man who fell by the wayside. So that was a tradition, still carried on. Wherever you went, on detachment or going to a hill station, equipment on, 50 rounds of ammunition, your rifle. Wherever you went, you probably one's rifle. And also, these bungalows were part of a long stream. They were an echelon. They went almost far as I could see either side. They were to our left, looking out to our field. To the airfield was an artillery, a British artillery unit, or battery, I suppose they were called, or artillery regiment, really a regiment, more than a battery, really a regiment. And then there was a Yorkshire regiment, a foot regiment, next to them, and then beyond that there'd be the odd people like the medical corps or Royal Engineers, Army Service Corps, all the odds and ends probably. And to our right we had a Sikh mountain battery. They're quite interesting people. We play hockey with them quite a lot. They were jolly good players. You should play barefooted. Never wore shoes when they used to play hockey. They were fast. And all this nonsense, I think, about the Sikhs in this country have to wear helmets. There, Sikhs, as they finished work, came the helmets, was the first thing they took off. They took them off, they just had their net round their beards and their hair tied in a little knot on top. And that's the way they relaxed. You see a lot of wrestling, a lot of weightlifting, and that's the way they played hockey. Not this term, originally a turban of, but I don't know. So let's mention that here. But that's the Sikh regiment there next to us, and we became very friendly with them. I didn't come across any other Indian regiments close by, but there was a Indian light infantry regiment further down, and the Indian light infantry, they wore the Indian type shoes, and they marched really fast. Could have been a light, of course, that's the idea of a light infantry, get anywhere quickly, and their band used to play. I don't know how fast they could play, but it's terrific. The rate they marched at a normal steady pace is about 120 per minute. I don't know how many they did, I don't know, but it was certainly fast. It takes some doing. Still, that was a light infantry's job, and so on. Of course, our billets, of course, the same type of bungalow would be our canteen, where we could get the evening meals and buy odd things across the counter. Get quite nice meals across there. Favourite used to be liver and chips or anything like that, but of course you couldn't get anything. I think it was run by a Mohammedan. You couldn't get any pork. You could get pork sausages, because the contractor who should run these things, fair they call them, he was a Mohammedan, and he couldn't touch, even in a tin they can't touch it, because there's pork inside. So food's limited to a certain extent, but quite